You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 18th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Got quite a program for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Lots of things in the news. No guests today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking to Professor Eddie Gloud of Princeton. Don't know if you've been following Cornel West's comments in an interview with Christopher Hedges. Fascinating stuff. Eddie Gloud in the same department, or at least in the same university. And a frequent guest on Cedar on Sundays. Maybe the Sam Cedar Show, I can't remember. It's been so long, folks. I don't remember anything anymore. My child has destroyed my memory. And I think that is probably a... I think that is actually a biological imperative. I think that actually evolution has made it impossible for parents to remember their lives prior to their children as a way of them not harming their children. Otherwise... It would be horrible what would happen if I had any recollection of how great my life was before my child. God knows what I would do. So fortunately, I can't remember anything prior to that. And really anything during my the life of my child. I know yesterday was Tuesday. Folks, I do know what's going to happen in the future. Now, as you are well aware, today is May 18th. That means that we have only the 19th and the 20th and then the 21st until the rapture comes. If you ever wanted, thought, it even occurred to you, you debated to become a Majority Report member, now is the time to do it. I have stated on this program that I will give a 110% refund to any member if, in fact, the rapture does come this weekend. And I'm working right now with our payment processing people to do this automatically. Unless I hit the kill switch on the 12:01 the day after the rapture, unless I hit the kill, it will automatically refund 110% of your membership. And today I have received an email from member Tom K. Sam, greetings. If the rapture comes, I'll still be here. I don't know why he thinks that, but I'm not going to argue with him. That said, I will match you 100% refund guarantee to new members, thus making it a 220% guarantee. This is either a wonderful opportunity for you to become a member and support this program, or a great, great business move on your parts. So do not hesitate. Head over to majority.fm right now. Become a member before it's too late. Before it's too late. It's been raining all week in New York, And it's supposedly going to be raining all week. And a lot of people could say that's about cleansing. Cleansing before it's time for us all to go north. And by that, I don't mean Albany. I'm talking north up into the sky. You can call the program at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I will take your phone calls throughout the program. 646-257-3920. Friday not only will be the day, I believe, before the rapture. When is the 21st? 19th, 20th? That's right. The 21st is Saturday.
Saturday.
Right.
Saturday.
That's
I have
convenient.
A gig on Sunday, so I'm hoping it doesn't.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that. I wouldn't worry about that gig. But Friday could also very well mean the death of the War Powers Act. Professors Bruce Ackerman and Una Hathaway, law and political professors at Yale, published a piece in the Washington Post this week. The War Powers Act confronts its moment of truth. Friday will mark the 60th day since President Obama told Congress of his Libyan campaign. According to the act, the declaration started a 60-day clock. If Obama fails to obtain congressional support for his decision within this time limit, he has only one option: end American involvement within the following 30 days. That would be great. Unfortunately, there is a lot of fudge in terms of what constitutes American military involvement. A, Obama has not even attempted to get authorization from Congress. B, the Democratic congressional leadership has not shown any interest either. He sent a letter on March 21st to Congress telling the Libyan campaign stated it was consistent with the War Powers Resolution. The Justice Department issued an opinion that said that was valid. So why hasn't the president been asking for an extension? These professors speculate that by Friday, the administration's legal team is likely to announce that the clock stopped ticking on April 1st. That's the date when NATO took the lead in the bombing campaign. Since NATO is running the show, the argument will go the War Powers Act no longer applies and the president doesn't have to go back to Congress after all. I don't get this reasoning at all, but I believe these law professors in that they're speculating that this could be the reasoning that the Obama administration would offer. And in support of that notion that that reasoning is a joke, they say American planes and drones have continued their bombing long after the April turnover. The drones are still flying over Libya. The cost of the mission is $750 million and climbing. It's a sheer fiction to suggest we're no longer a vital player in NATO's Operation Unified Protector. Especially so when an active duty American officer remains at the top of NATO's chain of command. Their fear is that once Obama crosses the Rubicon, future presidents will simply cite Libya when they unilaterally commit America to far more ambitious NATO campaigns. And they make it clear that this is precedent setting. Even Bush, with his illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, his invasion of Afghanistan, got congressional approval. Clinton acted unilaterally when he started his bombing campaign in Kosovo, but he had Congress approve special funding for his initiative within 60 days. The entire operation ended in 78 days. The House of Representatives is out this week. Congress can't approve the operation before the Friday deadline, but under expedited procedures specified by the act, speedy congressional approval is feasible next week. Nothing's done. The War Powers Act, which is in and of itself, many people would argue, unconstitutional, would be essentially not even providing the lipstick for the pig in this case. Meanwhile, on other happy fronts.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd. Lay, hoodlay, hoodlay, hee-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd.
Is it safe?
Lay, hoodlay, hoodlay.
Is it safe? No, apparently it is not safe. Do you even know what that's a reference to? You guys are looking at me. You never seen The Marathon Man? Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ.
I apologize.
That's all right. God damn. I'm gonna get somebody in here who's like 65 years old. Just sit down and so I can go like, hey old man, I don't know what you're talking about. Actually, you probably have to bounce it up to like 70, 75, 80, 85. Supreme Court had a ruling. I guess this was actually 2 days ago. It was a review of a Lexington, Kentucky case. Kentucky v. King. Basically, what happened is the cops saw a drug deal taking place in a parking lot. They rushed into the apartment complex. I guess, I don't know if they were on stakeout or what, looking for a suspect who'd sold cocaine to an informant. I guess it was a sting operation. But the smell of burning marijuana led them to the wrong apartment. They knocked on the door. They announced that they were cops. They then claimed they heard sounds from inside the apartment that they said made them fear that evidence was being destroyed. They kicked the door in and found marijuana and cocaine, but not the original suspect who was in a different apartment. When a case goes to the Supreme Court, the facts are in no way reopened. So that these facts stand. It's not a question of whether or not they actually did smell it. It's not a question of whether or not they actually did fear that evidence was destroyed. All those things are stipulated. The Kentucky Supreme Court said this evidence is inadmissible. Because any risk of drugs being destroyed, remember, there's no warrant here. And we have a Fourth Amendment, which protects privacy and says that you need reasonable search and seizure. You need a warrant. So there's no warrant here. And the Supreme Court said the evidence is inadmissible because any risk of drugs being destroyed was the result of a decision by the police to knock and announce themselves rather than obtain a warrant. What they're referring to here is there are circumstances where you do not need a warrant to bust into someone's house. These are called exigent circumstances. They have been found over and over again that there should be a very narrow definition of what these circumstances are. They are limited to emergency situations demanding an immediate response to prevent serious injury to the arresting officer or other persons. The exigency exception can excuse a warrant for an in-home arrest when the probable cause exists and there is a compelling reason for not obtaining a warrant. For example, a need to protect an officer from danger or a need to avoid the imminent destruction of evidence when entry in hot pursuit is necessary to prevent a criminal suspect's escape, to respond to fires or other emergencies. This is from Case Fisher. But the argument is that cops can't go around and create these circumstances. Because if they could, then the notion of needing a warrant really wouldn't apply. You can't, cops can't run into a building, I guess, and say, like, put one of the other cops on a ledge, have him there hanging by his hands, and say, we got to bust into the suspect's apartment so that we can save the cop. And they also cannot go around and bang on everybody's door, and say, cops, and wait until they hear somebody shuffling around in there that sounds like they're going to destroy evidence. However, that's not what our Supreme Court found. Supreme Court found they do not need a warrant to enter a home. If they smell burning marijuana, knock loudly, announce themselves, and hear what they think is the sound of evidence being destroyed. Supreme Court ruled on Monday in an 8-1 decision. Remember, I said over and over again, the Supreme Court, since mid-50s, has in every appointment, no matter who was being replaced, has moved to the right. Narrowing our civil liberties, expanding the rights of corporations, and make no mistake about it, you know, the so-called liberals on the court are not liberal. They just are liberal relative to those Neanderthal nut job movement conservative types that sit on that court. Justice Ginsburg, in dissent, wrote, "The court today arms the police with a way routinely to dishonor the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement in drug cases. In lieu of presenting their evidence to a neutral magistrate, police officers may now knock, listen, then break down the door, never mind that they had ample time to obtain a warrant." Alito,
surprise, surprise,
took pains to say that the majority, this is the guy who said that that young girl, I don't know if you remember this case, could be strip searched for virtually no reason, that the majority was not deciding whether an emergency justifying an exception to the warrant requirement in exigent circumstance actually existed. He said that the Kentucky Supreme Court expressed doubt on this issue, and any question about it when the exigency actually existed is better addressed by the state court. All the Supreme Court decided, Alito wrote, was when evidence must be suppressed because the police had created an exigency. So in other words, it's okay that the cops created it. It's okay. So the issue isn't whether or not they actually created this. They're basically, they say that the state Supreme Court can make that determination because that's more of a factual determination. They're simply saying that even though the cops created it, they could take advantage of that to attack your Fourth Amendment rights. Ginsburg went on to say via the Lawyer's Gun and Money blog, "The question presented, may police who would pause to gain the approval of neutral magistrate dispense with the need to get a warrant by themselves creating an exigent circumstance? I would answer no, as the Kentucky Supreme Court. The urgency must exist, I would rule, when the police come on the scene, not subsequent to their arrival, prompted by their own conduct." So that's basically it. I mean, under this ruling, if you thought there was some guys smoking pot in apartment 3B, you could send a cop up to the roof, have him hang down by his fingernails, bust in there to say, ostensibly to save the cop, and then bust everybody in there. She writes that the heavy burden has not been carried here. There was little risk that drug-related evidence would have been destroyed had the police delayed the search pending a magistrate's authorization. In other words, the cops, they smell pot, they go get a warrant. As the court recognizes, persons in possession of valuable drugs are unlikely to destroy them unless they fear discovery by the police. They had no fear to be discovered by the police until the cops decided to knock on the door. Nothing in the record shows that prior to the knock on the apartment door, the occupants were apprehensive about police proximity. How secure do our homes remain if police armed with no warrant can pound on doors at will and on hearing sounds indicative of things moving, forcibly enter and search for evidence of unlawful activity? Well, there you go. So you're in your house. You're listening to your music. Matt, that I think it's probably a question as to whether or not you actually downloaded that properly. Or maybe you've received a BitTorrent of a movie. Or maybe you're watching Justin TV and they've got MSNBC playing on there. Cops knock on the door. You shut your computer down. Uh-oh. They can come in. So, more happy
time. High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay, hoddle-lay.
There is good news,
loud
folks.
Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay, hoddle-lay.
646-257-3920 if you want to vent a little bit. There is good news.
for the top 400 U.S. taxpayers. It's a near record year.
Wow! This is coming from Too Much, Sam Pizzigatti, and of course, Don't Be a Putz. In 2008, the IRS revealed last week 400 Americans. 400 Americans. Do you think we could get 400 Americans in this office? No.
They wouldn't be comfortable.
No. Mm-hmm. No. We could probably, we could get 30. We could get 40.
Yeah, they would.
I mean, no one would be able to sit. And then we'd have to take out all the everybody would be standing. 400 Americans reported at least $110 million in income on their federal tax returns. Those 400, in a year that ended with millions of Americans out of work, averaged, oh, that has to be $110 billion, averaged $270.5 million each, the second highest U.S. top average income on record. In 1955, America's top 400 averaged, in 2008 dollars, $13.3 million. It's all adjusted for inflation. The top 400 richest people in America averaged an income $13.3 million. The top 400 in 2008, after taking inflation into account, amounted to more than 20 times the income of America's top 400 a half a century ago. $13.3 million, now $270 million. But 1955's top 400 didn't just make far less than 2008 top 400. The rich in 1955 paid far more of their income in taxes than today's rich. I know I'm a broken record on this, folks, but this is what you need to know. We're in the middle of a class war. Maybe, sadly, we're at the tail end. You are losing. Because I know, I feel very safe in saying, none of those 400... they're not listening to this show today. The data I have shows that the top 400 in the country, they listen to the show mostly on Mondays
Friday.
And Thursdays and casual Fridays.
Yeah.
They never listen on Hump Day Friday, Wednesday because they're golfing. Or they're paying someone to golf for them. And I keep harping on this. I said we were in a class war on Radigan the other day. And it's fun just watching people just sort of like swallow their tongues. It's fun. The rich in 1955 paid far more of their income in taxes than they do today. In 2008, the new IRS data show the top 400 paid only 18.1% of their total incomes in federal tax. The top 400 in 1955 paid 51% of their total incomes in tax. Can you imagine? How is it possible? How is it possible that there's anybody making any money anymore? Because those guys who are only making $13.3 million in today's dollars back in 1955, those richest Americans, those richest 400, 50% of it was taken in federal taxes. How did they not all go galt? When they got together at the meeting, they said, do we go galt? Or do we get the Powell memo and decide to spend 30 years, starting in the late 60s, early 70s, to systemically steal money, use the government as an apparatus to redistribute 99.99999999999% of Americans' wealth upward to us. And then someone say, hey, do you really think we have the ability to do that? I said, well, yeah, particularly if we let the other 2% of Americans join us. Let the rabble be the other top 2% of our income earners in this country. And then we will have no problem screwing the rest. And how will we do it? We'll do it through capital gains on stuff that's completely not productive. I wonder what percentage Maybe Don't Be a Putz will find this for me. I wonder what percentage of capital gains taxes, capital gains taxable income, is actually a function of investment that could potentially create any real economic, or let me rephrase that, jobs activity. Because that's why we're told we need to have capital gains. That income that a hedge fund guy makes, that income that a real estate speculator makes, by simply buying a house and reselling it, by somebody who holds a stock for 20 seconds. That's apparently what the average is. The average stock is held for 25 seconds. By flipping that, making that income, getting only a 15% of capital gains tax, I wonder how much economic growth is created. Because we're kept telling you, like, you have to have capital gains so that people invest to create jobs. I wonder how many jobs are actually created by these activities. My guess would be the percentage is stunningly low. And if there is any percentage which does not create jobs, that should be taxed as income, period, period. Particularly when we know that this is a consumer-driven economy. I mean, I would wage to guess that far more jobs are created by people going out and spending on stuff by demand than any activity that would generate income that is subject to capital gains. It's stunning. You don't even have to go back to 1951. In 1992, IRS stats show that only 33 of the top 400 paid less than 20% of their incomes in federal income tax. Less than 10% of those top 400 paid less than 20% of their income incomes in federal income tax. In 2008, 253 did. We're getting totally screwed. Totally screwed here. While we have all this talk of austerity and destroying Medicare, it's stunning. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. Numbers 646-257-3490. We'll be right back after this. What's part of that, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, what's part of that plan to wage this class war on us? National Journal reports that major U.S. newspapers have increasingly shifted their attention away from coverage of unemployment in recent months, while greatly intensifying their focus on the deficit, a National Journal analysis shows. The analysis, based on a measure of how often the words unemployment and deficit appear in major publications, portrays a dramatically shifting landscape of coverage over the past 2 years. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, USA Today, Washington Post were examined. Mentions of unemployment have been dwindling since they spiked to 154 in the month ending August 15, 2010. So the highest amount of reference of mentions of unemployment. This is a daily. Spiked to 154 in the month ending August 15th, 2010. Over the month ending Sunday, there were 63. I'm sorry, a month. Deficit mentions, meanwhile, have surged to 261 in the month ending December 15th. So even at their peak, it was still almost half the mentions of the deficit. The broadening gap demonstrates just how effective conservatives have been at changing the narrative of economic policy from one dominated by talk of fiscal stimulus to one now in lockstep with the notions of fiscal austerity. I don't know why this is just conservatives, unless it's frankly, it's the ruling elite. It's the establishment. You know, we'll talk to Eddie Glaude about this tomorrow when we talk about Cornel West's statements, which Cornel West has taken a lot of grief for, as far as I can tell. But there's very little that Cornel West said that I disagree with. I mean, I think Cornel West is more inclined to see this from a racial standpoint, and understandably so. Marin had a great joke back in 2008. I'm going to butcher it, but it was something to the effect of, like, you know, with Barack Obama's election, black people will finally have the chance to feel like what it's screwed to be, what it feels like to be screwed by one of their own. And certainly just from a progressive standpoint, the notion that the guy with the bully pulpit, the guy who's one of the most eloquent speakers we've probably had in generations, can't keep jobs at the forefront. It's not even can't, won't. It's a betrayal to the American public. And with black unemployment nearly double the rate of the unemployment measure in general, it's very hard to not see that as a betrayal to black people. But we'll talk to Eddie Glaude about that more tomorrow. Meanwhile, Robert Reich had a piece on his blog saying raising the debt ceiling is used to be a technical adjustment. Now, not so much. He basically states what we've been saying for a long time. This is being used by the right to pursue an ideological agenda that if we genuinely wanted to cut the deficit in this country, you need to only look to the people's budget. It reduces the long-term budget deficit more than either the Republicans or the president's plan does. He writes, when I read through the people's budget, my first thought was how modest and reasonable it is. It was produced by the House Progressive Caucus, but could have easily been generated by Washington centrists 40 years ago. He asks, will the president and congressional Democrats cave in to the extortion by the House Republicans? When even Nancy Pelosi says everything's on the table, you got to worry. We can fortify the president and congressional Democrats and prevent them from moving further right by doing exactly what the Tea Partiers are doing, but in reverse. The message from the People's Party should be unconditional. No cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. More spending on education and infrastructure. Pay for it and reduce the long-term budget deficit by cutting military spending and raising taxes on the rich. The people's budget is the template. But what if the president and Dems show signs of caving? This is the heart of the progressive dilemma. Which leads to a more basic question. Are we ready and willing to mount primary challenges to incumbent Democrats who cave? Sadly, I think the answer, as far as I can tell, is no. There's just not enough anger out there. It's coming. I think the anger is growing. I think the willingness of people to take direct action is increasing. We have a bunch of videos on the blog today. Matt, what are the blogs? What are the videos that we've posted over there? The sound's not, the sound's fine, but they're not amenable to just being audio. What are some of the videos we have over there? We've got a couple of protests. You got it?
Hold on 1 second, pulling it up.
Well, here's one. Here's one of.
Yeah, we have storming the castle at the J.P. Morgan Chase shareholder meeting.
Yeah, let me tell you about this. Okay, this you should head over to Majority.fm to see these videos if you haven't seen it. First of all, this took place in Washington State. Police maced several elderly protesters Tuesday at the J.P. Morgan Chase's annual shareholder meeting in Columbus. This is coming on the heels. You should know that there's the Huffington Post. Posted the other day a story about a set of confidential federal audits accusing the nation's five largest mortgage companies of defrauding taxpayers in their handling of foreclosures on homes purchased with government-backed loans. There's so much foreclosure fraud that has taken place, that is ongoing, both in terms of defrauding actual homeowners by attempting to foreclose without the proper chain of title. In this instance, this Fed audit shows that these banks essentially sold their crap to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac without disclosing what crap it was. The audits accused the five major lenders of violating the False Claims Act. It is a Civil War-era law crafted as a weapon against firms that swindle the government. The audits were completed in February and March. The Internal Watchdog Office at HUD referred its findings to the Department of Justice. I didn't mean to imply this was done by the Fed. It's a federal audit done by Housing and Urban Development's Inspector General. The resulting reports lead like a veritable indictment of major lenders, the sources said. State officials are now wielding the documents as leverage in their ongoing talks with mortgage companies aimed at forcing the firms to agree to pay fines to resolve allegations of routine violations in their handling of foreclosures. The audits conclude that the banks effectively cheated taxpayers by presenting the Federal Housing Administration with false claims. They filed for federal reimbursement on foreclosed homes that sold for far less than the outstanding loan balance using defective and faulty documents. This is probably what Schneiderman is also using in his investigations. And so people are getting angry. Hundreds of people from dozens of communities, organizing groups, swarmed the Tuesday meeting of J.P. Morgan Chase's annual shareholder meeting to demand the company overhaul its widely criticized foreclosure policies. J.P. Morgan Chase has improperly broken into the homes of its borrowers in order to pursue foreclosures and has been accused of robo-signing thousands of key foreclosure documents. George Gohl, executive director of National People's Action, which helped organize the protest, said he and several orderly protesters were maced. There must have been about 10 police for every banker, Gohl told HuffPost. They own the Columbus Police Department. It was insane, said Robert A. Cree, the executive director of Grassroots Organizing, who said she was still in pain several hours after the protest from being maced. Fenny Dorsey, no relationship to New Dorsey, I believe.
No,
it's not your relative.
Old
right?
Dorsey.
A 55-year-old resident of Mexico, Missouri, told HuffPost she was maced. Saw other people being maced as well. We were trying to get to the Chase estate. Apparently, it's literally got a moat around it. It's actually a pretty funny video. They're all dressed as Robin Hood, and they come out of a bus with a big wooden bridge, and they put the bridge, like a pontoon bridge, across the moat. And these, you know, these are not intimidating people, I got to say. I'm sorry. Start running across it, these elderly people. Not that elderly, but we were trying to get to the Chase estate. We didn't make it as far as we were hoping, but we made it far enough to make a statement. We were walking forward, and the cop said, "Turn around." As we were making a turn, he just started macing us. Veteran union organizer Stephen Lerner said the police were notably more aggressive at today's protest than in events in the past. "The period when they're ignoring us is over, I think," he said. Police threatened another group of protesters with dogs. On Tuesday in New York, the shareholders of Marshall and Isley Bank of Wisconsin voted to give $71 million in bonuses to failed executives as part of an acquisition deal. This is a bank that had posted its 10th consecutive quarterly loss of $142 million. The bonuses would cover half the loss if they were retained. This is stunning. They held this meeting in New York to get away from Wisconsinites who had been badgering him with uncomfortable questions. At the Marriott in Times Square, Furlong was met by a towering piggy dressed as a banker in a giant inflatable fat cat with a grip on the throat of a worker in a hard hat. About 700 protesters outside, including New York and Wisconsin firefighters, kicked up a ruckus which echoed through Times Square. You remember, this is the bank that a lot of those Madison firefighters basically withdrew all their funds from.
If you're trying to get away from protesters, is New York City really the best place to go?
Well, if you're a Wisconsin bank, it's an attempt anyways. And so you've got more and more people. There's a story out of Vancouver, Washington. First-term Republican Jamie Herra Butler faced down catcalls and booing at a two-hour town hall meeting over Medicare. Constituents were laughing and at Representative Dan Quayle for denying the existence of billions in special oil subsidies. The Senate just voted unsuccessfully to cut those subsidies. Maybe we'll talk about that tomorrow in the post show. I do want to talk about Newt Gingrich, though. We'll go a little long here. Because Newt Gingrich, listen.
I love this.
This is candy, folks. This is candy. Newt Gingrich is not going to run for president. Or, I'm sorry. He's not going to win for president. He's not going to win. He's not going to win his nomination. The guy is just, he's fun to laugh at. And why shouldn't we have a little fun? I understand that this is sort of a waste of time in some respects, but it's enjoyable. And it does hurt the Republican conservative movement. And anything that hurts them necessarily benefits us. If we have the ability not to allow it to enable the Democrats to be more shitty than they normally are, which is a big if, I understand. There's a couple of stories that are hilarious about Gingrich. Apparently, in 2005 and 2006, his wife, and I want you to get confused here, his most recent wife, Calista, this is the one that he was boinking when he was on that trip to, I think it was to Kosovo or to Rome. After he visited the Pope, his wife was in one room. He boinked his assistant in the other at like 1 in the morning. At least he spent some time. I'm sure there was some cuddling. That's appropriate, at least. Don't be rude. Don't be rude to your mistress, particularly if you're going to marry her after you drop your present wife. So 2005, 2006, she's working for... she works for the government, apparently. The House Agricultural Committee until 2007. So she had to list, she had to have financial disclosures for any revolving credit over the over $10,000. She revealed that her husband owed between $250,000 to $500,000 to Tiffany's.
Hey, what happened?
Wow! Ooh! Oh! What? The dude owes almost a half a million dollars to Tiffany's?
Like most Americans.
Listen, a lot of people want to know, Matt, why is that possible? And it's quite simple. When you have screwed over so many of your wives by sleeping around with other women, the necessity to spend $500,000 on jewelry seems quite obvious. I think you could also probably find that he probably owes like something like $1.3 million to a chocolate store and flowers. So Gingrich, that's just one story that's sort of funny. Here's Gingrich, who here he is on Meet the Press this past Sunday talking about how radical the Ryan plan is. But remember now, he is basically saying that the Ryan plan is so nuts, so radical, so dramatically changes Medicare that he can't sign on to it. This is the exact plan that the entire Republican caucus in the House, minus I think one or two people, voted for.
I don't think right-wing social engineering is any more desirable than left-wing social engineering. I don't think imposing radical change from the right or the left is a very good way for a free society to operate. I think we need a national conversation to get to a better Medicare system with more choices for seniors. But there are specific things you can do. At the Center for Health Transformation, which I helped found, we published a book called Stop Paying the Crooks. We thought that was a clear enough, simple enough idea, even for Washington.
Now, I don't know if you picked up on this. This is also a veiled attack on Governor Rick Scott of Florida, who was one of the largest Medicare crooks in the history of the entire program. His company had to pay a $1.3 billion fine. And he took the fifth in these hearings something like 50 times. Continue.
We thought that was a clear enough, simple enough idea, even for Washington. There are things you can do to improve Medicare.
But not what Paul Ryan is suggesting, which is completely changing Medicare.
I think that that is too big a jump. I think what you want to have is a system where people voluntarily migrate to better outcomes, better solutions, better options, not one where you suddenly impose upon you. I don't want to, I'm against Obamacare, which is imposing radical change, and I would be against a conservative imposing radical change.
So this man who has the deep integrity that a serial adulterer always exhibits. But I should say, it's not his, he's leaving his wives. Remember, he did it because of the country. He did it for the country because he was so patriotic that it made him sleep with other women. And we were all, I remember when I was young, before I was married, how much I loved the country and how much that forced me to, at the very least, attempt to sleep with women. At bars when I was drunk. So here he is crapping over the Ryan Care plan. And what are we now? 36 hours later? 48 hours later? And here he goes with his tail between his legs because he apparently stepped on a landmine. Here he is on the Greta Van Susteren show last night.
So let me say on the record, any ad which quotes what I said on Sunday is a falsehood. And because I have said publicly, those words were inaccurate and unfortunate, and I'm prepared to stand up. And when I make a mistake, and I'm going to on occasion, I'm going to stand up and share with the American people that was a mistake, because that way we can have an honest conversation.
So wait a second. Wait, play that again. This is stunning. Any ad that uses those words is a lie.
So let me say, on the record, ad which quotes what I said on Sunday.
Because you understand that when he was on that national, on the a much higher rated show, on that national show, when he reiterated, because you heard that beep in between the two clips from Meet the Press, he said it twice. And you know, we just played whatever, a minute 40 of him on Meet the Press, unedited, except for jumping to those two things. He didn't say anything different. You can go watch it. So when he was on the record that time, he's on the record this time. I'm going to go back on the record to say the last time I was on the record was not on the record. And if you use that record, then I am on the record now as saying that's a lie. Anybody who uses me on the record prior to my being on the record now is telling a lie. And anybody who uses me on the record now, when I go on the record in the future, looking back on this record, looking back on that record, you're despicable. Let's play this.
So let me say, on the record, any ad which quotes what I said on Sunday is a falsehood. And because I have said publicly, those words were inaccurate and unfortunate, and I'm prepared to stand up. And when I make a mistake, and I'm going to on occasion, I'm going to stand up and share with the American people that was a mistake, because that way we can have an honest conversation.
Now, the clip we just played just right then was actually a clip from Greta Van Susteren today. When he was talking about the clip from yesterday, he just repeated the same thing. This guy's fantastic. He's so fun. I'm so glad he's running. And I know, it's what's the relevant, but it's just too precious. All right, folks, we got to take a break. We'll go to the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call the program at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I will, in the post-show, touch upon what we're going to be talking with Eddie Gloud tomorrow. Cornel West really went off. I will also touch on this Jane Mayer story in The New Yorker briefly. We'll get to that more in the weeks to come. Real big story on the guy who blew the whistle on the NSA. And the Obama administration is prosecuting this guy in a stunning fashion. Well, just the fact that they're prosecuting this guy for genuinely whistleblowing on our government involved in illicit activity is... It's just, it's sad, man. It's incredibly sad. All right, folks, join me on the flip side. Number 646-257-3920. I am me at Majority FM. See you soon.